to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 620. My name is Camden Busey. I serve as the executive director here at Reformed Forum. I'm delighted to be back in the studio here in Grays Lake, Illinois, and let me introduce to you our guests. And before that, we even have one of our regular contributors, Jeff Waddington, who serves as State of Supply at Faith OPC in Fawn Grove, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Jeff. It's good to see you today.
Oh, good to be here, brother, and to talk about the book that we're going to be talking about. And good to see that you are back from hunting and all that fun yes. kind of stuff.
Right. All the good times. I went down south and was hunting with my father-in-law on his property. We haven't hunted that before. He's got a pretty sizable farm, at least I think it's sizable, that he leases out to farmers. So we had some good times there. So it was a good time to spend with him. And good experience getting up in a tree and letting your mind unravel for a few days. You know, some people really like the beach. For some reason, I'm geared towards liking the woods and the wilderness. So it works for me. There's this whole weird thing, I think, going on out in the progressive Northwest, like in Portland and whatnot, where people are advocating for what's called forest bathing. And that just means walking in the woods. But, whatever you want to call it, I understand the value of spending time in God's creation and away from our modern proclivities and technologies. But we've got some good wilderness in the areas where our guests are coming from today. I'm very pleased to welcome to the program again. We have William Bookestein, who is a pastor of Emmanuel Fellowship Church, which is a URCNA congregation in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I love it in Kalamazoo. Welcome back, Bill. It's good to see you.
Yeah, thanks. Good to see you too, Camden. And what did you call it? Forest bathing?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know
well,
that.
I don't.
Last week myself, but okay. I'm going to use that term maybe. But it's,
there you go.
Right. It's not my term, but that's if you want to be real progressive and hip, I guess that's what it is. But it sounds almost. I don't know what it sounds like, but anyway, we understand what it is. But we're also welcome today. Very pleased to welcome to the program Stephen Swetz, who is the pastor of Rehoboth United Reformed Church in Ancaster, Ontario. I guess that's in the Hamilton area. Welcome, Steve. It's good to see you too.
Yeah, thanks. Good to be here and good to meet you fellows and look forward to spending some time together.
Yeah, I'm delighted to have you with us and to meet you for the first time over the internet here at least. And we were talking just a little bit beforehand. Steve is a graduate of Mid-America Reformed Seminary and grew up in that area and now pastoring in the Hamilton area. A lot of Reformed influence up there, so it's a pleasure to have you with us. We're going to be talking today about a really wonderful little book, a new one, which is published by a Reformed Fellowship called Faithful and Fruitful, Essays for Elders and Deacons, which has been edited by our two guests today, William Bookestein and Stephen Swetz, which has contributions from a lot of people. There's a lot of wonderful essays in this book, including people like Bob Godfrey, William Godfrey. We have Bill Shishko, R. Scott Clark, our one of the editors here, Bill Bookestein, and we're looking forward to opening this book up today. We don't have too much to announce today. We got to watch out for the guys at PresbyCast to get on our backs for the announce-o-meter, and I promise that soon enough we'd try to get that time up over 10 minutes. But maybe not today. I always complain when we talk too much about announcements and stuff at the front end. But there is a skip button on your podcast app of choice. Nevertheless, I really want people to know about Lane Tipton's theology course. I know we've been speaking about it, but it's available now. It's online. You can go to the reformforum.org/store and you can buy it now. It's just $40, but it's 12 lessons, roughly 30 minutes. And when you purchase, you'll get download links to each of the videos, as well as to PDF handouts for each of the lessons. Elaine's working on a companion book. That's going to take some time to not only finish that, but also produce it and get it ready. But the course is ready. It's available. And we're really excited about it. I think it turned out really well. Looks excellent and amazing. The video crew did a wonderful job. The audio sounds great. And of course, the content, the material is tremendous. So it's a course on foundations of covenant theology. And in that lane is not just getting at some basic details of covenant theology, but getting underneath it to talk about God's purpose for humanity. That even as he created man in his image, male and female, he created them with a plan and purpose to bring them into a higher estate of union and communion, to bring them into glory in the heavenly places. And so he works that thread and develops those themes throughout the 12 lessons, and it's tremendous. I think if you really spend time and learn the lessons and meditate on them and then understand them in the biblical context that he provides, it really is. I try not to sound hyperbolic, but it really can be life-changing. And I think, Jeff, you probably agree with me there.
I would.
And we encourage you to take a look at that and use that possibly in your churches, maybe at home on your own. But for $40, it's really, I think, a great deal, and that would help us out also in our mission and help Lane out as well. So we encourage you to take a look at that. Just head over to reformedforum.org. You'll find it, and it's ready there for you. Just download it and binge watch it to your heart's desire, heart's content. So back to the subject today, talking about pastoral ministry, but not just that, ordained ministry, speaking of pastors as well as elders and deacons. There's always a need for resources that help ministers and elders and deacons to address the task before them. And to do so in kind of sometimes nuts and bolts ways, because sometimes we read so much about theology or history, or we're dealing with commentaries and talking about the ins and outs of particular texts, and you just expect everything else in church life, which is an enormous amount of material, to just kind of be taken care of on its own. But there's all sorts of things going on in the life of the church that ministers and elders and deacons need assistance and guidance on. You know, we're talking about officer training or how to be a clerk or hospitality, you know, even the way we think about our greeter schedule for the worship service. How can we be warm and welcoming as a congregation and meet the needs of the people? Visiting the sick, you know, all sorts of things like that. So I'm always encouraged when we find new and worthy books like this because they're helpful in a way that connects the dots for people. So they're rich and based upon the scriptures and based upon the theology they're in, but also help us to see how that works itself out in very practical, like I said, nuts and bolts ways. So really what we're talking about with the book today, Faithful and Fruitful Essays for Elders and Deacons, is a book like that, that I think is going to be really, really useful for lots of people within the church. So with all that being said, Bill and Steve, either one of you, however you want to take this, I'd love for you to talk about the project as a whole and talk about working with the folks over at Reformed Fellowship and how did this project come about? Because I take it that you were not the originators of the project, although that you, in an analogous way, have become the consummator of it.
Okay. So, Camden, let me just first say, you referred to the book as a little book, and this is why
I'm sorry.
No, this is why I'm intimidated because it's a 300-page book, and Camden's like, "Oh, it's just a little book, just 300 pages."
Here's the problem: I have a PDF of it, so to me, it's like 200K.
Okay, so it's small in terms of digital space, but
anyway, you're right. Yeah, it's substantial. There are many chapters. You're right, and they're all
probably a morning read. Morning read for you. So Steve and I were given this wonderful opportunity to edit this book from Pastor Mike Brown. He wrote a book or edited a book 15 years ago or so called Called to Serve, Essays for Elders and Deacons. And over the course of years, he had acquired questions and other invitations to write a follow-up volume. And so probably 6 or so years ago, he sent out an invitation to a number of potential authors who sent in some form of either finished or nearly finished manuscript. And as Mike was in the process of beginning to edit that, he got called to pastor a church in Italy. And so he had to send it off to Steve and I to take up. And but it's been really wonderful working with experienced churchmen to bring these chapters to life. So that's been a privilege. We feel like we've learned a lot just reading what these gentlemen have contributed.
Yeah. And Steve, how did you get involved?
Yeah, working with Bill. Bill and I go way back as friends. And he suggested we work on this together. So we took up this manuscript, which had a few less chapters. And we looked at the previous volume and tried to look to see if there's any holes in the ministry or in the work of the officers. So we added a few chapters, asked a couple of new contributors, and tried to combine in this volume then, working together, and an emphasis upon knowing your office. They've been called by God to these offices, elders and deacons and pastors, and then following that call with a knowledge of what the scriptures require, but also a heart committed to shepherding God's people and reaching the lost and ministering in an effective way.
Yeah.
So it's been a real pleasure to serve.
Amen. Well, thank you for doing it. We have 20 chapters. I want to correct myself or any misconceptions here. 20 chapters, all rather substantial, and then there are also 4 appendices. And I'd love to just kind of provide a survey of some of the topics. I've mentioned a few. Bill Shishko has a chapter on training church officers. There are chapters that are addressing the mission of the church. But Bill, your third chapter here, your chapter, which is the third chapter here, is on positive leadership, leading like Jesus and not like Rehoboam. I was wondering if you can open this up and talk a little bit about church leadership. Why was this subject on your mind, and what led you to work on this particular one?
Yeah, well, if I could back up just a minute, one of the problems in the manuscript when Steve and I received it a couple years ago was there were no Orthodox Presbyterian contributors. So we thought that's an immediate flaw with the volume. So we're glad that we were able to draw in 3 OPC ministers. So hopefully that. And a couple Canadian Reform, one Canadian Reform ministers.
So what does it say when the OP guys brought in to do, training church officers? Is that not something you do over in?
Yeah. Ooh. Well.
Wow. Okay.
Right at the start. To be honest, we really, really appreciated that chapter tremendously because of Bill's work over the years on officer training.
Absolutely.
And maybe Steve's experience has been a little different than mine, but I don't think that in my experience and just hearing from other colleagues that the churches that Steve and I serve have necessarily a program for officer training. There may be local traditions and customs which are very useful, but I think what Bill Shishko is proposing is a much more organized and systematic approach to officer training, which I learned from tremendously.
Yeah, I think that a lot of churches struggle in that department, and I haven't always been good about that in our congregation at Hope. But I remember when I was an intern down in Wheaton at Bethel OPC, they were pretty good about that. Often linked the officer training up with the session meetings, but just to give proper due where, well, proper credit where it is due. We have used on our last round of officer training and training some deacons, one deacon and one elder for ordination. We did use The Elder and The Deacon, which are books by Cornelis Van Damme. And so very thankful for him and his work up in, I think, the Canadian Reform Seminary, if I'm not mistaken. So there is a rich tradition, obviously, within the continental tradition. And so we're thankful for Bill's book, but certainly recognizing the work of many others within the continental tradition, too.
I would just say one thing about Bill's chapter is he has a podcast himself.
Sure.
Bill Shishko, in his role as the regional home missionary for the presbytery that covers New York City and Westchester County and Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And he has, in the footnotes to the chapter, he's got the links to various resources for training of elders and deacons that I'm sure would be of great benefit to go even. So this is a good entree into more further material, not just the wonderful chapter, which I think is really good, but it leads to further resources that if a church doesn't have a tradition or doesn't have the pastor doesn't have in his mind a plan for how to train elders and deacons, that this is a good place, even if you're not OPC,
yeah.
It would be a good place to start.
Well, absolutely. Well, Bill, at least, and Steve, you know, feel free to jump in whenever you'd like, but you know, at least in the third chapter here, speaking about positive leadership, there's always kind of like this cottage industry of like Christian leadership books sometimes. And there's a wide range of them where you could end up with anything and everything in there, you know, principles from Joel Osteen or even more motivational stuff, which can be very helpful from a guy like John Maxwell or something, for example. But here you're providing a much more, you know, biblical example and scriptural basis for what you term as positive leadership, in many ways contrasting Jesus and his servant leadership with that of Rehoboam. How can these lessons and why are these lessons particularly useful to, you know, contemporary church leaders? Why is it important for us to learn these things so that we can lead in a proper way?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, Camden, you maybe hinted a little bit at some of the leadership models in the broader Christian culture in which we live, which can be very dominant. And in a sense, I think some of the more confessional traditions tend to be less focused on the model of leadership or even, you know, the fact that elders and deacons are leading, or in the sense of being culture shapers. I think we tend more to view elders and deacons as decision makers, oftentimes making decisions behind closed doors during council meetings or consistory meetings, which is a significant part of how elders and deacons lead. But I wonder, I've been less conscious of the fact, I think, over the years that elders and deacons, along with ministers, are culture shapers. We're always leading as leaders in the Church of Jesus Christ, from, you know, the way that we worship to the way that we raise our families to the words that we speak when we announce decisions, to whether or not we even communicate decisions that have been made in more kind of behind the doors settings. And so we wanted to promote a positive model of leadership. So, because I think where sometimes leadership isn't emphasized in churches, at other times the assumption is, well, leaders just have to be very strong and have to, we end up sometimes, maybe partly because of a certain temperament that draws men into ministry, we tend to be sometimes overly strong. And I think a lot of people are hurt by unhelpful leadership. And so I wanted to start this chapter by contrasting Rehoboam and Jesus Christ. Rehoboam thought that the best way to lead is sort of a heavy-handed, iron fist approach. And I'm going to be stronger than my father, and they'll respect me because of the dominance that I demonstrate. And I think that can be a temptation for us as officers, ministers, elders, and deacons. And but Jesus shows a better way, a way of course, he knew how to be strong and could be very hard on those who were opposing the kingdom of God, but was gentle and nurturing and compassionate and loving. And so our hope is that the principles brought out in that chapter will encourage officers in churches to take another look at, what does it mean for me to be always leading? I am never taking a moment off from leading. So in all of the decisions that I make, am I demonstrating the leadership of Christ or a more sort of fleshly driven model like Rehoboam's?
Yeah, that's really helpful. I mean, and the fleshly tendencies are always to gravitate towards exertion of power in the form of, you know, coercion or submitting, making people submit or having sort of control, where this is top-down authority, where you must do and say as I say, you know, and in a way we see that picture with Rehoboam, and we see what happened with the kingdom under such ungodly leadership. And eventually it catches up with you, mainly because the Lord will not bless it and will not allow it to persist. And Christ, of course, is our king and ultimate example, but he gave his life for the sheep. It's a very different form of leadership, but he did so without, you know, compromise and without, I should say, violating any of God's principles. But it's a wonderful thing. It's helpful, and it reorients us around you know, the biblical conception rather than some sort of pragmatic model, which often dominates within church context.
Now, Bill, I was going to ask you, Bill, if I may jump in here. Sorry.
Go ahead.
In your chapter, obviously Rehoboam is your negative leadership and Jesus is positive leadership, but you flesh that out even further in terms of how that looks in the life of the elder or the deacon or the minister in that way. As a mindset or an attitude, can you spell that out a little more for our listeners?
Sure. So I was positively influenced in this chapter by James Smith's work on the power of love in leadership and the fact that people, most of us, unless we're coerced by a power that we can't avoid, we are going to do what we love. We're going to, we're going to sort of follow our hearts in the sense that the way that we're leaning. And so, you know, just wanted to promote this idea that positive leaders understand the power of love and that love is actually a better, I don't want to say leadership mechanism, but it's a better way of leading than force or coercion or fear. And I think a lot of times, especially when leadership gets hard, we kind of retreat into those places of, you know, we're scared where things aren't working out. And so we fight back and we try to manipulate people or we try to scare people or, and that's not the model of the gospel, right? I mean, it's the love of Christ that compels us to be faithful. And so just the idea of leadership, not so much as being sort of pushed along by leaders, but being drawn along in ways that resonate with hearts that have been transformed by the love of Jesus Christ. And so our leadership should actually help people better understand the leadership of Christ and actually how we've been delivered from the leadership of the devil, who is always manipulating and forcing and contriving and deceiving. So yeah, I think that was very important. So I think Smith has done great work in that area. And I think there's a lot of application for how elders, deacons, and ministers lead today.
That it strikes me as a way of looking at attractional leadership, right? And stirring people up. Sounds like a New Testament writer, you know, stir one another up to good works, you know,
love and
that
good
kind
deeds.
Of thing. Mm-hmm. Love one another, right? And, but anyways, I thought it was a really helpful reminder as to, especially, you know, if we've been elders or deacons or ministers a long time, we all probably started with that view. And we might, unless we purposely revisit the issue over and over again, it's easy to get off track because we're surrounded in a world where, as Jesus said, the leaders of the Gentiles lorded over their followers, right? Very different in the church, or it should be.
Mm-hmm. I think for Bill's chapter, if I can chime in here,
please.
It being toward the beginning of the book kind of sets the stage for what's going to come after. But this is a picture of leadership, grace-filled leadership built upon the grace of the gospel. And so the chapters that come after about the shepherding, ministering to the sick, continuing in prayer, the minister's household or the elder deacon's household, all of these things flow out of leadership. And Bill points out in that chapter that everybody then who's called to these positions, whether it's parents in the home or officers in the church, will be leaders. So what kind of leadership will be taking place? Yeah. And so his chapter that comes to later, elders and deacons as hospitality leaders. It's just an application of this bigger principle that our leadership should reflect that of the sacrificial leadership of Christ.
Yeah, I appreciate that. That's a great way to put it. And yeah, the leadership is not an option for church officers, I mean, by definition. But one person, even in the secular space, kind of defines or distinguishes leadership from management. Management would be about kind of maintaining control, and not in the sense of like, I need to control this, but in terms of managing things so that they continue to operate correctly. But leadership in is much more about change and motivating change and guiding constructive change. And if we think about what the Lord is doing in the life of his church, he is building his church, and it's he that does it, and the Holy Spirit works to sanctify his people. But he also gifts to his people, and many of those are spiritual gifts that are geared towards ordained ministry. And so those that the Lord has provided to do those things, in a sense, by definition, are meant to lead to change. You know, that is to provide spiritual fruit, hence the title in many ways, you know, Faithful and Fruitful, of the book itself. And that is all about leadership, biblically understood. I really appreciate that.
Cameron, if you take that, like the model of a father in the home, a tyrannical father can keep his children kind of in order as long as he's able to wield that power, as long as they're in the home. But he hasn't necessarily won their hearts over to what is best. They haven't truly learned to appreciate the heart of God under a tyrannical father. And so a tyrannical father might look like, wow, that guy has an orderly home, everybody is submissive to him. But as soon as he, you know, dies, or the children move out of the home, or whatever it is, they're going to revert back to, you know, wow, dad isn't controlling us. And so now they're going to be who they truly have learned to be during that time, and probably not very healthy under a tyrannical father. So I think we just want to avoid that in the Church of Christ. We can create sort of the illusion of order through heavy-handed leadership. But, you know, we all can identify people that we would follow just about anywhere because of the fact that they have loved us. They've shepherded us. They've shown us the best way. They've shown themselves to be trustworthy. And so I think you're right. Change is inevitable in the church, and navigating change well, I think we believe is going to be best done by leaders who have earned the right to sort of be respected and followed. And so we're hopeful as the gospel changes us into better leaders, that we'll actually have healthier congregations as well.
Yeah, and I appreciate so much of the emphasis, you know, often throughout this book. It's there not only just explicitly, but also implicitly in terms of the qualifications for these offices. But there's also something that Danny Hyde said in his chapter on prayer. He's drawing from some of the books and the vows within the URCNA about prayer really being the first duty of an officer, and especially a minister. Steve, I was wondering if you might be able to comment on that, because it flows out of a comment you just made in terms of these activities. Bill's chapter on leadership is up front because it leads to so much that comes after, but the very next chapter is on prayer. You know, how significant then is prayer for the leader, and what does it say for the leader who is really deficient in prayer, or in many ways practically doesn't think that it's top of his list?
Yeah, in our book of church order, as you mentioned, continuing in prayer is the first duty of the deacon, elder, and minister. And it's purposely put there as the first duty. I mean, there's a danger in the busyness of our lives to think of the things we have to get accomplished. And whether it's in our session consistory meetings or whatever it is, we just don't have enough time for prayer. I think what Danny Hyde puts in perspective there is that this is actually the most important task of the elder, deacon, and minister. And they're not, frankly, very useful until they have been spending their time in prayer. So it's a very practical chapter of how to work that, of how to balance that. But I think as those who have served Christ Church, you either read it in a book and you learn early on, or you learn it the hard way through life.
Yeah.
The more you're in prayer, the more effective you will be as a servant of God.
That's a helpful marker also for identifying perhaps potential candidates for office in the future. If you find a person who is not prayerful, that can be a great warning sign. Doesn't mean it can't be developed, but it's definitely something that needs to be present and cultivated. And again, how is it cultivated? It's often cultivated by the officers that are serving in the church, that they would lead in prayer. And if they don't, the sheep, the rest of the sheep will follow suit. That's a very dangerous thing. On that very point, you know, that's perhaps one, you know, prayer is huge in terms of leaders needing to model it and demonstrate it in order to cultivate prayerful lives within the people. But another area or aspect of that that I've seen so many times in so many different churches is that of hospitality. And Bill, I'd love for you to talk about this, because that's one where that can catch on and spread. But if you also have leaders who are inhospitable or really struggle in that department, that also can spread throughout the congregation. Why do you find it so important that leaders would not just tell other people to be hospitable, but would also lead in hospitality?
Yeah. Well, 1 Timothy 3, verse 2 lists hospitality as one of the requirements of elders. And I think that deacons, while that term isn't used in the list of requirements for deacons, it seems that the office of deacon was instituted explicitly because of a hospitality need. And so at least as much, if not more so, deacons are bound by their office to be hospitable. And there's just so much that, so much, I think, negative cultural information that has cluttered our understanding of hospitality. I mean, it's either viewed as a feminine attribute today, or it's viewed as an industry. And I think we really want to put in the front of the mind of and heart of the leader is hospitality is essential to understanding the gospel. I mean, in a sense, the whole picture of redemptive history is God being hospitable, right? In the beginning of the Bible, he hunts down two people who had lost their right to a home with God, and redeems them and their believing seed throughout the entire Bible. And the end of the Bible is a picture of God's people in God's city with him. And so he's the host at the end of the story of Scripture. And so elders and deacons, along with ministers and all of God's people, are called to really be models of the story of the gospel that they have come to believe and is now working out in their lives. And so, and I think that's why elders and deacons are, again, are pace setters. There's really nothing that is required of an elder and a deacon that isn't also sort of expected of all of God's people in some degree or another. But God's people are to be able to look to elders and deacons and the minister to say, you know, what does it look like in concrete terms for me to be a Christian? And being hospitable, that is showing love to strangers and those who don't seem to have a natural claim on our time or our space or our love, is just part of what it means to be won over by the love of Christ and to show that to others. So, we want to be sensitive in this chapter, because in a sense, I think we're really trying to recover something that has either been lost or maybe never fully emphasized the way it should be as a requirement for office. So we realize that not everybody is equally comfortable with people or gifted in hosting, but it is something that we all have to be working toward as leaders in the Church of Jesus Christ. And I think that, you know, evidence shows that where leaders are hospitable and where guests come into a congregation, which congregation itself has been loved by leaders, but then the guests begin to experience love from the start, and they feel like this is a place for us because the leaders have modeled it. It's just a place that the Lord is going to bless. That harmony that exists between leaders, members, and guests is going to really own God's blessing.
I'm really struck by the way you put that in a certain capacity that sometimes we have this very narrow idea of what hospitality is, that it is a very specific mode of opening your home to guests and providing them a place and food and conversation. Well, that's hospitality certainly, but it's also a way of life, and you can be hospitable to someone perhaps in their house. There's a way to be a hospitable guest or even at the church or just in general life, of being open and warm and welcome and loving in a holistic way with people rather than being guarded and controlling and seeing other people merely as tools or means to whatever personal ends you may have.
Right.
And so if we flip that on its head and you have, again, to connect with the earlier chapter about a more servant and positive form of leadership, it's very different. The inhospitable person would be more like Rehoboam, that I use my kingdom for my ends, and if you can't give me something, then what do I need you for? Versus the positive form of leadership and a servant form of leadership is all about giving and about loving and being of service to other people, much more Christian way to think.
And I noticed that, Bill, you did go further and point out that hospitality is something that ought not to be shared just amongst believers with themselves, but also there ought to be a purposeful extension of hospitality to your neighbors, believer or not, right? So it's a way of I may be confusing this with another chapter, but it's a way of welcoming people in getting unbelievers to visit your church. If your people are trained to be hospitable, that is welcoming, they're more likely to get friends and family and work associates and so forth to come and see what the church and the gospel is all about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jeff, you're right. You talk about the distinction. Hebrews 13 begins by saying, "Let brotherly love continue," and then it adds in the second verse, "Do not forget to entertain strangers." So there's a distinction. Both are important. We need to love our brothers and those who are close to our own family members, our church members. But don't forget in doing that to entertain strangers, to practice hospitality. And I think it's easy to forget. We have a lot of family obligations. We have, maybe in your church, you have, a lot of extended family you're going to spend time with after Sunday worship service. Don't forget to entertain strangers in that. Yeah.
Hmm. We have other many, many other chapters. We're not going to be able to get to all of them today, but we certainly have those. Just reading some titles: ministering to the sick and dying, the office bearer and household management. Steve mentioned classical Christian catechesis by Scott Clark, managing the offerings of God's people, and then getting acquainted with the congregation's needs. I'm really interested, and I saw this one stuck out to me. I'd be really interested, Steve and Bill, if you could speak to chapter 11. About the topic of avoiding burnout. There's another book on the subject called Burnout. I think it was by Christopher Ash. That is a little book, but one that was really helpful. I read a few years ago. What was the intent in including this chapter, and why is this such an important subject, especially for those in pastoral ministry? But we hear many, many stories also of elders and deacons that are really struggling.
Yeah, I think it's the reality in which we live, that people are busy and they don't want to say no to commitments. And so this chapter seeks to balance out how to work diligently, work hard, and yet be refreshed. The chapter two after it, Sabbaths and Sabbaticals, kind of follows up on this idea. But we've seen a problem in our churches, and I think in other denominations, it's the same problem of men being called to these wonderful tasks and yet ending up in an empty situation. The tank is emptied out and they have nothing left to give. And then they become unuseful in the church. And sometimes in the minister can be detrimental to the Church of Christ. And so I think a number of our pastors have have gone through this, have struggled with this. And the goal then is to try to avoid it by taking care of yourself, taking proper Sabbaths, and and working within the time frame God gives us with all the callings we have. I mean, as a pastor, I'm a husband, a father. I have these other tasks and responsibilities, and balancing life is part of the goal of good leadership as well. Because it's an example then to the congregation of priorities and things like this. So I think it's a wonderful chapter by Andrea Ferrari. He's one of our missionaries in Italy, a native Italian. He brings a little bit of a different perspective with that as well.
With a name like that, you can't go wrong.
I think one of the, this chapter is also, I think, a testimony to just the wonderful elders and deacons that serve in our churches. I mean, the fact that burnout is not desirable, we're trying to avoid that, as Steve said, but the fact that we have men who are, you know, putting themselves in that position in addition to the families that they serve, the jobs that they have, their other expectations. We have just amazing men in our churches, and you guys do as well. Just servants. But we don't always know how to, as Steve was mentioning, steward our energies so that we have something to give out of. And we've all probably heard sort of groans when a man gets nominated to office, or like, you know, three more years or four more years, or finally I'm finished. And, right. And yeah, it's, there's a lighthearted aspect to that, but it's also serious. I mean, this is a really big, heavy duty calling that guys are called to, and we want them to come out of service not worse off than they were when they went into it. And so Andrea gives some really helpful suggestions. Not just, I mean, there's some practical tips, but also just sort of the spirituality of service and doing it in a way that we're drawing strength from Christ rather than simply spending. Mm-hmm.
Jeff, what stuck out to you on some of these middle chapters here? I mean, there's so many here.
Steve already brought up the issue of Sabbaths and sabbaticals.
We just received a poll on that from the Committee on Ministerial Care. Because there's a lot of misunderstanding on that. A lot of folks don't understand the purpose of a sabbatical and wonder why someone would need one. So that's at least something our denomination is looking at.
So there's actually two chapters called Tending the Shepherd, part one and two, right? Mm-hmm. The first part is honorable provision, and that's, of course, dealing with the how the minister is to be remunerated. But it's from the perspective of dealing with the elders and the deacons, presumably, who would have some oversight of this issue. Then you have, so let's talk about that, brothers. What wisdom or insight does the author of these two chapters, the author of the both chapters, but the first section on honorable provision, what is there a way you could sum up the chapter? Care for or provide for your minister, but I mean, beyond that, what, flesh that out for us, if you would.
Well, yeah. It's a touchy subject.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true.
Yeah, watch yourself. You know, congregants end up watching the things.
So this is why we asked the Canadian Reform guy to write this chapter.
Yeah, right.
Right, exactly.
So this chapter is written by Peter Holtfluer, both of those two chapters. He's a pastor here in Ontario at a Canadian Reform church. And he's written these very helpful chapters. But it kind of gives to the congregation a mindset of ministerial compensation. And no minister enters the ministry, no godly one at least, for financial gain. However, our church order, book of church order, says that the congregation is to provide honorably for their pastor. And what does that look like? And so he gives some practical tips, but as we see throughout this book, the spiritual nature of supporting those who are shepherds in the local congregation. In our history, it's not very common for a minister to have another job outside of the full-time pasture it. So that impacts, the type of provision the congregation will have to make for him. And that involves, his time off, realistic expectations. We've all seen, we've all seen situations where things go bad because of unrealistic expectations. Congregations think the pastor should be doing this and looking at that. I saw a couple weeks ago, I saw a Babylon Bee article on a minister driving a 98 Corolla. People in the congregation by their pastors that spending so lavishly. And as those are, they're funny critiques of a real caricature. And so, Peter helps to keep people from falling down that path, and just to give guidance to the leaders of a church.
I think in addition to that, the chapter is meant to help what could otherwise be a very difficult conversation between, better for elders and deacons to learn from, a more objective person in this conversation than the minister who, feels like he has, they have different expectations of compensation or whatever. You're going to be very partial in that position as a minister trying to communicate to your elders or deacons. But hopefully just, this chapter allows the decision makers to step back a little bit and say, we'll listen to this guy. He's not asking for a raise here in the chapter. He's not, arguing for this. It's just biblical principles for taking care of the minister. So hopefully it removes a little bit of the emotional tension that the conversation might otherwise have.
Oh, that's a good point.
I found the general principle of the provision for the pastor being in the same ballpark as the average situation of members to be helpful. A good principle, a rule of thumb to operate by. Camden's giving me that look like, yeah, I like that idea. I feel he's now feeling called to Beverly Hills.
How are you gonna do your what is it, woods bathing, or no, what was it, what's the thing called?
Forest bathing or wood
forest bathing. How you can do that in Beverly
the palm
Hills?
Trees.
He's happy where he is, right?
I don't think I can handle it out there, I'll tell you that. I get burned up anyway, but there's another side of this too. I mean, it's always helpful for pastors and staff to have advocates, and it is really awkward for sometimes to bring these issues up. So having a book or a chapter like this that talks about some of these issues, and to have mutual trust among your session or consistory is just absolutely important. Where it's not looked at some battle or tension where you're trying to like hammer out negotiations an athlete who's trying to finalize a free agent deal or something like that. Yeah. But there's a backside of this too, because that mutual trust needs to be built, and there needs to be open lines of communication. In chapter 14, there's a really helpful chapter on how to evaluate your pastor.
Yes. Yep.
And that's something I wonder whether most churches do. But and if they do it well, tell us about this chapter and why this was included. Because I think it's really useful.
We should probably say just a little bit about the chapter, because you should probably get Pastor Gordon on to.
I'd love to.
It's gonna be a great one just to focus on the entire show, just evaluating the pastor. Subject. So I can say a little bit about it. We at Emmanuel have had a pastoral review process in place for about 4 years, and it is. It's a hard experience, I think, for everybody. For the in our church, the elders and deacons work to contribute to evaluate me, and it's hard for those guys to, they're reluctant to be put in that position. But we all sense that it's good, it's helpful. It's hard for me to receive feedback, but I think the reason that Chris is promoting this idea is that I think pastors, maybe you guys can chime in on this, but I think pastors receive far less substantive and constructive feedback than many congregants realize. Good sermon, is nice to hear, but it, you know, what do you do with that?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so, I think, you know, what Chris has done is divide up the ministry into several different facets and say, what does it look like to be a well-rounded minister? And, you know, and if you're, if every minister is not entirely well-rounded, right? We all have our flat spots. And how do we identify those things? And to do so in a timely fashion, right from the start of a ministry, so that the review process isn't used, you know, after problems have come up in the church as sort of a way of, you know, well, it could just be very hard if it's not done right from the start. So this is just, I think, I hope this really catches on. I don't know if it's common in your guys' churches, but I don't know of a lot of churches where it happens.
I suspect that it's, from my own background, that it's not a common occurrence. However, as I was reading the chapter, I was reminded of our ministerial information form, which has a self-evaluation section, and it's similar. Although you have the chapter has less categories, but it's the same idea: preaching, counseling, visitation, etc., family life, things like that. It's probably a good idea. You're right; it's uncomfortable on the part of the pastor receiving the evaluation. It's uncomfortable on the part of the elders giving the evaluation because they know that it's perhaps not going to be enjoyable as an experience. But I think in the long run and over time, I would imagine the longer you're in a place, the better you get to know one another, the more that process might become just a regular part of, if you're committed to it, part of the annual cycle. However,
yeah.
Assuming an annual evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's pretty straightforward. I didn't find anything odd about it, other than the fact that you're not relying upon the the handshaking at the end of the Sunday service being the place where evaluations are rendered.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they can become, it's sometimes hard to know whether someone is just giving you a platitude or the expected comment.
Or if the criticism is even valid or worthwhile.
Right. The other extreme, and I remember sitting down and telling folk at one congregation I served that the time to criticize a pastor, especially for a sermon, is actually not right after the service. I said that's the weakest point. I think you brothers would probably, I think, concur with that, especially because you know, and I know, we know that we've not done as great a job as maybe we would like to have done. Of course, that's not, the Holy Spirit isn't limited to that. But in terms of our own reaction, you know, to what we've done,
sure, it stings the most.
That beating yourself, self-flagellation, right?
Right.
You know, they did it to themselves physically in the Middle Ages. We do it sometimes to ourselves emotionally. And I knew of him. I had a man, a highly esteemed pastor, who admitted to me that early in his ministry, Monday, there was seldom a Monday that went by that he didn't consider committing suicide.
Mm.
Now that was probably, that had a lot to do with his, you know, mental make emotional makeup. But the point is, that was the low point. Now that's not true for me. I don't know if it is for you, but the point is, the evaluation, if you give it a structure, right, will be much more healthy for the church, for the pastor in the session, than if you rely upon,
sure,
either self-assessments alone, or, you know, you rely upon people passing the assessment along to the,
yeah,
pastor as they're greeting him on the way out the door.
Yeah. No, that's useful. Yeah, and it's an important thing because, yeah, you can't just rely on, oh, I'm not hearing anything, I must be doing a great job, or nobody's left yet, or everybody did leave. You know, these aren't always the greatest bellwethers, and having open communication, honest communication, it not only helps just in the area of like pastoral like performance, we shouldn't even, maybe that's not the best way to put it, but it's just best to have all of your expectations and understanding open and available. So, you know, you might even find you have very different ideas of what pastoral ministry is. And then that can lead to greater understanding and searching the scriptures to have a more biblically and reformed model and understanding of that. Your brothers, there's a lot we could talk about. At least in the remaining time, I want to at least address the issue of serving in the broader assemblies. Ronald Squeers, I believe that's the pronunciation. Is it right? I've seen that name before pronounced Squeers. Am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good. Yeah, he has the chapter number 16 here, Navigating the Broader Assembly, Serving at Classis and Synod. For our Presbyterians, of course, that could be applicable serving at Presbyterian General Assembly. Or if you're in a giant Presbyterian church, Presbytery, the Synod, and the General Assembly, if you have that level. You know, this can sometimes be overlooked. At least in our Presbyterian tradition, the ministers are members of the presbytery, not members of the local church. You know, that's one polity difference with the continental tradition. But we're all called, especially as ministers and elders, to serve not just in the local congregation, but we have an obligation and a duty to serve in the broader assemblies. And that's really not optional. You know, we can have greater or lesser involvement in terms of committee work and all that kind of thing. And some people really thrive at the broader assembly level and others not so much. But it's never serving anyone great if you don't show up. Or if you're there, you're sitting in the back on your computer doing something else and not participating and serving. And we've all been there or wanted to be there sometimes. Speak to that, if you would, brothers, about the importance of this form of service and this form of leadership. Why is this such an important thing here for ministers and elders and deacons in variety of capacities to be involved in these broader assemblies?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's a good chapter. We all know people that love the broader assemblies and that love parliamentary procedure. And they're not just Presbyterians either.
You might have been taught by one.
But yeah, exactly. Some people thrive on those things. But for some of the denominations, each church sends delegations to the broadest assembly. So there are men there who might not particularly look forward to the business part of the meeting. And yet they have a very important task and role. And it's not a godly stance to just check out and happen to be there. But you have to be involved, committed. If it's a deliberated body, your position built on scripture is important. How voting works, the nature of voting, the role of voting, the authority of voting. These are important questions. And I think, yeah, our guys go to a lot of different seminaries, and some seminaries probably equip men better than others on these subjects. But I think it's an important reminder, and even for me reading it again, of the importance of what's taking place in these assemblies. We're not isolated, independent congregations. But rather, we are part of a federation or a denomination joined together in the gospel of Christ. And therefore, we matter to each other. Right. And the opinion of my brother is important, and I should listen to it. And the discussion, though it may be long and technical at times, is important. And especially when you think of some of the things that are dealt with in these assemblies, when you start to deal with things like justice and equity, these are weighty moral decisions and debates that take place. So it's a very helpful chapter.
And I think especially for, you know, a first time delegate, you get the agenda ahead of time, or, you know, it might be a couple hundred pages, and it can be so intimidating. So just hopefully being able to just walk through this chapter, and there'll be, you know, some Presbyterian readers will have to adopt some things. This is probably the chapter that is most, will probably most closely resonate with continental polity. But, you know, by translating some things over, it at least will give, I hope, first-time delegates a sense of familiarity with the process and the procedure.
Sure.
And so just like, I don't know if you guys are, doing a speaking engagement. Sometimes you like to get up to the podium beforehand. You can just kind of feel out, you know, just get a little more comfortable with the setting. And I think one of the first things this chapter is going to do is just help delegates feel more comfortable getting into a setting that they might feel pretty uncomfortable in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Helpful.
Well, there are certainly several other chapters. I mean, I would like to do some further episodes on these different subjects, and if we can call up and schedule some of the authors, I think it'd be really handy because there are many that we can dive into. But I'd like for you, either of you brothers, if you just have any final words or thoughts, or what's really your hope for people and for churches as what's your desire for this book as it's now available? What would you like to see?
Yeah, I think one thing you mentioned that there are four appendices. One of those appendices are study questions for each chapter. And I think the design that Bill and I had in writing those study questions out were that sessions or consistories or even a men's Bible study in a church can sit down and work through these things as part of an office bearer training. Maybe of any other work, the necessity of training is so key. And you can do so much before somebody enters office, but on the job training is frankly the majority of the practical learning. And using a resource like this, and there are other good resources as well, but this comes alongside, and it can be a wonderful way of talking deeply about these important issues of office and leadership. Mm-hmm. So My hope and prayer is that it's a blessing to churches and to church leaders.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would echo that and add that, you know, a lot of us are very familiar with just very high educational expectations for ministers. And that's right. We're glad for that. And we have high expectations as well for the competency of elders and deacons. And that's right also. But the way that we prepare elders and deacons in comparison with how we prepare ministers, we hope that this book will help fill that gap a little bit. And in a sense, partly just raising the bar and saying, yeah, we have, you know, the Lord has provided wonderful men and we expect he will continue to, but we want to make sure that we are fulfilling our responsibility to prepare men and to be prepared ourselves. And frankly, you know, Paul talks about those who desire the office, desire a good thing. We hope that the book will also inspire among younger men a desire to be in office and to begin preparing for that even before they're potentially eligible because they know it's a good thing to aspire to.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, it doesn't serve us well when people only hear of, complaints from the officers about how hard it is or this, that, and the other. But to be reminded of Paul's words there and encourage people to pursue that, it is a good thing. Well, I appreciate both of you, brothers, and also you, Jeff, for jumping in today. But this has been a fun conversation, and I hope people will pick this book up. It's available from Reformed Fellowship. You can find that at reformedfellowship.net. We'll have a link to that in the episode description. You can click on over and get the book. You can also get the companion book by Michael Brown. He's got the foreword to this one, but you can find Called to Serve as well, here edited by our guests today, William Bookestein and Stephen Sweats. Brothers, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having us.
Good. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll point everybody back to the websites. Of course, you can find us at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs and publications, upcoming events, that sort of thing. And of course, remember, head on over and take a look at Lane's course, Foundations of Covenant Theology. It's available online. And head to reformedfellowship.net, pick up a bunch of books. You will benefit for sure. I do want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.